performancism sets you up for a life of ladder climbing. And we know, not only from the Bible, but from the testimony of countless people, but the higher you climb on the ladder, the longer it gets, and the further apart the rungs get. Mm-hmm. The people at the top of the ladder are the ones that are so unhappy. Mm. If that is the sum of your identity, is your resume or your transcript, that is slavery. If there's a God in that equation, God is purely a slave driver who is only interested in your output.
5 centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hello and welcome to another broadcast of the White Horse Inn. According to David Zoll, our religious crisis today is not that religion is on the wane, but that we are more religious than ever, and about too many things. But our religion, he says, has been secularized. We may be sleeping in on Sunday mornings in greater numbers, but we've never been more pious. On this episode, Michael Horton and Adriel Sanchez continue their conversation with David Zoll concerning his new book, Seculosity, as they focus this week on the quest for self-justification in work, technology, politics, and the overall spirit of performancism.
David, you describe our culture as one where busyness actually has become a virtue. I mean, we all say this all the time. I'm so busy, I'm so tired, so on and so forth. And a lot of times we are, but you point out that we kind of feel proud of ourselves that we're driven by busyness. How has this become such a virtue for us?
Isn't it interesting? Because it's how are you doing? It's not fine. You say, I'm busy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you're right, we're not lying. The way that the pace of life today is very fast, breakneck speed a lot of times, especially if you're trying to keep up with the Joneses. But this applies, by the way, up and down the socioeconomic and geographic map. But if you think about it, what would it mean about you if you weren't busy? This is how we know it's become a virtue. Someone says, well, how are you doing? Well, you say, well, I'm okay. I've got nothing really to do right now. You want to go do something?
You're lazy.
That is seen as that's a problem.
Yeah.
You're doing something wrong. You're less than those who are crushing it or who are so busy that they have no other time. Because to be busy is to be in demand. It's to be valued. It's to be justified.
Yeah, yeah. Whereas previous generations would have been happy to say, well, let's go fishing.
Mm. Well, the idle rich, isn't that what every Jane Austen novel in the book and in the world is about? How actually the people at the top are those who have less to do.
Yeah.
And you would never deign to have an occupation.
Yeah.
You know, that was for those who are way beneath you. Today, the exact opposite is true. It's fascinating. I mean, there were different modes of justifying yourself in that regard by your parentage, by all that sort of thing. But it's funny that I'm justified by how my schedule.
Hmm. When would you say that shift took place? I mean, because you think if back in the day, leisure was viewed as that's a symbol of status. I don't have anything to do because I'm someone special. Now it means you're lazy. What changed in our society to make us say, no, when you're busy, that means you're somebody, and when you're got nothing to do, that means you're nobody?
Hmm. Well, some would say it was when the rich started working harder, which was around, I think, in the late 50s or something like that. I'm not being a historian in that respect, I don't quite know, but I know that it has happened.
Yeah.
And that somehow careers are no longer occupations, they're callings. And, you know, Christians, we believe in vocation, but it's sort of on steroids today, or on crack, you might even say. If you listen to, you know, graduation speeches, it's always do what you love, find your passion and go for it. And if that's true, then you better never stop working. If that's really the point of life.
Mm. That's your passion.
That's your passion, your dream. And that's a huge burden to lay on a 22-year-old.
Mm-hmm. I know they're hearing that too, because I don't use that language with my kids. Mm. and they use it with me.
Wow.
Well, this is my passion. This is my passion. I'm thinking, it is so thick in the culture that this is how they're thinking. And I think of Augustine here, that we don't actually enjoy anyone or anything but God.
Mm.
We use other things. We use our callings to enjoy God, to glorify and enjoy God. We don't glorify ourselves and enjoy our callings. We enjoy God in our callings and through our callings. Is that...
It's like if you take God out of the equation, that's what we have right now. It's, I have to enjoy... And so therefore, you have people switching jobs constantly.
Because
right?
That's my God.
Or never stopping. I mean, that, there's a whole chapter in the book about... what's the joke from The Onion is a laid-back company allows employees to work from home after 6 p.m.
Yeah. That's great.
How true is that, though?
Yeah.
It's the conquering of leisure and life. Work. What's the motto? And I don't know if this is actually true, but they say that the motto at Amazon was that work-life balance is for people that don't like their jobs.
Mm.
Wow. Wow.
What? That's a dark view, actually.
Yeah.
And humans, it's really of human beings, not as creatures, but as machines.
Absolutely. You describe performanceism. I love these neologisms that you have here. Bringing different ideas together in one word. You describe performanceism as the assumption, usually unspoken, that there is no distinction between what we do and who we are. Your resume, you say, isn't a part of your identity. It is your identity. What makes you lovable, indeed, what makes your life worth living, is your performance. Why is that a problem? Unpack that a little bit.
Well, performanceism is such a default assumption, I think, today. It's a problem because you're going to get older and get worse at your job.
Yeah.
You're going to, it makes no allowance for the fact that we have control over far less than we think we do. But also, if life is just a process of figuring out what I'm good at and doing it all the time and doing it the best, it becomes a competition. If there's a God in that equation, God is purely a slave driver who is only interested in your output. But performanceism is, again, it also sets you up for a life of ladder climbing. And we know, not only from the Bible, but from the testimony of countless people, but the higher you climb on the ladder, the longer it gets, and the further apart the rungs get.
Mm-hmm.
The people at the top of the ladder are the ones that are so unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not necessarily, when we talk about the despair and even suicide and self-harm in our culture,
mm-hmm.
it's not really, suicide clusters are all in these very affluent, high-achieving scenarios, because the further up you get, the B minus mm-hmm. is now a reason to not just bail on your school, but to bail on your life. It sets up life as you're on a razor's edge, and one false move, and you're done for. And that creates this underlying rage, because sometimes people are really good, and life doesn't, and they do perform highly, and they, for whatever reason, they don't actually get the rewards they think they're owed, or sometimes there's all sorts of complicating factors. But performanceism is essentially, it's not saying, by the way, in no sense would I say that our performance at the things we love is unimportant. You know, of course it's great. You know, be all that you can be, as they say in the army, but, or they used to. It's more that if that's all, if that is the complete, if that is the sum of your identity, is your resume or your transcript.
Mm.
Well, then that is slavery.
Yeah. You know, it's so wild to me how that performanceism has even slipped into the church. I mean, how often in churches today do you hear, what are you doing? What ministry are you a part of? And people begin to, I mean, their Christianity is wrapped up in the ways that I can serve, what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. Because if I'm just coming to the church to hear a message about the grace of God and receive that, well, that's not enough. You know, I got to be doing, because my identity is wrapped up in that. And so it really, it's outside all over the place, but it's also something that's started to bleed into the church as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Maybe the church was one of the places where it started, you know? I mean, really.
It could be.
Really. Yeah. In pietist circles, you know, where it's an individual, personal kind of thing, it's did you have your quiet time?
Mm.
You know, the way I grew up, did you miss your quiet time?
Mm.
And the people who really, whose value was the greatest in the kingdom were the people who had their regular quiet time. They never missed it. But they could have been the older brother in the parable of the prodigal son. And then on the other hand, you have now, it seems like, people who were raised in that reacting against that in a more public service-oriented legalism to say, well, what did you do this summer? Did you build wells in Africa? You know, our church went to Africa to build wells, and I don't think that you were on the bus.
It's I tried to point this out in the book in some way because it's different sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
In both cases, it's what, because personal devotion is a beautiful thing. And acts of service and even advocacy and justice, these are wonderful things. But when that becomes your replacement religion, then basically the message from the pulpit from up front is perform.
Yeah.
Perform in this way that I have said is important. And since human beings are sinners and we often don't do the thing that we know we should do, that sets you up for massive resentment if you're the person speaking or the person hearing.
Hmm.
Because why won't these people do the things I tell them to do?
Yeah. I read a book some months back called Homo Deus by atheist historian Yuval Noah Harari. He says something really, the whole book is about how humans are progressing to this place where we're essentially going to deify ourselves. We're going to become godlike. And he says, we're getting to the point where, quote, you could buy for yourself the strength of Hercules, the sensuality of Aphrodite, the wisdom of Athena, or the madness of Dionysius, if that's what you're into. Up till now, increasing human power relied mainly on upgrading our external tools. In the future, it may rely more on upgrading the human body and mind or on merging directly with our tools. Technology has really come a long way, but can it make us godlike? And you've written a little bit about technology.
Well, you know, again, within the transhumanist movement, there's lots.
Can you explain it? What is transhumanism?
Sure. Transhumanism is the merging of machine and human and technology with humanity in a way to sort of prolong and optimize life. And, you know, science fiction has been talking about this forever in terms of cyborgs and Cylons and things like that. But here you have a very active community with a lot of money behind it, mainly sort of the cliche is that it's based in Silicon Valley, but the attempt is to prolong life indefinitely. Immortality is really the end goal here. And
you just get your parts replaced. You don't become more and more a machine, right?
You get either maybe you get uploaded to the cloud in some way, but yes, you know, to live forever, to be in complete control
salvation
of everything. I mean, what it is godlike.
The brain, once it becomes this mechanical, this machine-like, is it really human anymore? And this is what I got from reading Harari, too. Once you're talking about this much augmentation to prolong life, you're no longer talking about prolonging the life of a human being. The person whose life is prolonged is actually now a laptop.
That's true. That's scary. I mean, the further you get into these discussions, the wilder they get. And I sometimes think that for all of these innovations that our friends in Silicon Valley have given us, they don't seem to have read much science fiction. Because most of it's about how this goes terribly wrong. And it's a conjecture, but you want to say, well, I think the human imagination is both glorious in its ability to imagine how wrong it can possibly go, but it's nonetheless, I don't know. I think a lot of it is premised on the fact that death is final. And as a Christian, you know, I believe that it's not. I believe life is a vale of tears and that, in fact, the kingdom come, the second Jerusalem, I mean, that's what I'm kind of excited.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Isn't that, at the end of the day, what it's really about? Two different visions of what life and death mean for us.
I believe it is.
Yeah.
And people tell you that even Christians, I think that we've gotten everything is about, when everything becomes about building the kingdom and you know, personal sanctification, you shrink down the faith to just a very, you know, the 50 years you're on the planet, rather than seeing this enormous cosmic history. We're talking about heaven, and we're talking about hell, and we're talking about the life to come. And when we limit ourselves only to the imminent frame is what the word is, or just the here and now, we forget that the hereafter is a big part of the equation, and our hope is really to be found not in the improvement of our lot right now, although that can be great as a response to the gospel, but our hope is to be found in the sort of the new creation.
We don't have our best life now.
Yeah.
No, and at the end of the book, I actually think that the church would do well to talk a little bit more about death.
Because absolutely.
It will be I think T.S. Eliot said that the church is the place you go to be reminded of things like sin and death, which you spend the rest of your life and a lot of with technology distracting yourselves from or trying to outrun. And in fact, to sort of sit down and to hear about these things, it can be an enormous relief, especially when it's in light of the grace of God.
Yeah. And, you know, in Scripture, sin and death go hand in hand. We can talk about the eradication or the removal of death through technology, but we don't know how to solve the sin problem. And as long as there's a sin problem, there's going to be a death problem. You know, we might be able to cure all sorts of diseases, but we can't keep people from killing each other or from withholding food and resources. And so it really continually points us back to the hope that we have in Christ. You know, we're not going to solve the problem of death. That's something that Jesus already did, and sin. And unless you solve both of those issues, you're not going to solve either one.
Oh, great point. You say, David, it makes me sad when religious leaders try to entice people into the pews by means of fresh, religiously sanitized distractions, or when they see it as their missional duty to craft services in which each and every moment is filled with language or light.
Well, I'm trying to get that. I think a lot of what technology does, we've been talking about how it prolongs life. It also distracts. We love it because it distracts us. You know, it entertains us. Amused to death, I think, isn't that Neil Postman's book? And boredom has become a thing of the past for a lot of people. If you're sitting in a doctor's office, you know, you start playing Candy Crush, or you can get more work done and you can sort of justify yourself that way. But the church, I think it can either rise to that and try to play by the world's rules and create a more, I don't know, flashy. This is not a license for the church to be painstakingly boring, but I think that the church can also, in its liturgy, there are pauses and silences, and there are, you know, we are passive, that we're there to receive. And that is a countercultural thing, but I find it a deeply hopeful thing. It's also an embodied space. It's why the internet can never really replace the church. I always joke that you have to be close enough to someone that you can smell them. And it might not be a person you really like. It certainly won't be a person that looks like you. And that's a wonderful thing that we can do. But I think churches, when we try to compete, we miss part of what is so beautiful about the witness, which is that it's not busy.
Mm-hmm.
I remember hearing, I think it was one essayist said that he thought that one of the reasons why secularism or atheism is on the rise is not that people have really thought hard about the claims of Scripture and rejected them, but that they've so distracted themselves that there's no space in which to even address those questions. Mm-hmm. And I think he's probably right.
Church is a place where we come not to have more distractions from the truth, but to come away from the distractions to hear the truth.
Yes.
And to be with others who are similarly shaped by that truth.
Which is why it can be such a ironic or kind of tragic thing when the church is seen as like it's painted as a crutch or another way to distract you from your insufficiencies. When the testimony of most Christians I know is that you go to church and you're reminded of the reality that all the buffers that you spend 9 to 5 your week erecting from reality are stripped away. And for a moment, maybe something breaks in.
Hmm.
You know, as with all of this stuff, I think that we think that the gods of sort of Silicon Valley came down from the mountaintop and handed us these gifts and smartphones, and everyone took them up. But then we realized 10 years later that there were curses, you know.
Mm.
And that is almost universally acknowledged as true at this point, that there's been some massive downsides to our very quick adapting smart technology. And it's hard to talk about technology critically without sounding like a Luddite, and that is sort of a real, a really bad thing in a lot of sectors. And yet, I'm not a Luddite. I run a ministry that has used a lot of online marshaled a lot of online resources, and I really think that a lot of the ways I know people that I'm great friends are through technology. So I need to say that up front, that technology is sort of a neutral thing.
Yeah.
I think it can be used in different ways. And when it's used as a vehicle or a tool for self-justification, to constantly be asserting or claiming or leveraging your enoughness, your righteousness mm-hmm. from the world, well, then it can become very destructive
yeah.
is the only way to say it. I think that the relationship we have with our phones and the internet changed the game in a lot of ways. Well, for people who are interested in the dynamics of the human soul and how we clamor for justification and see that as central to the human, basically, identity and as a sinner, is that you're constantly trying to justify yourself on your own two feet. If that's where we are, if you're that kind of a person, well, then it's a massive opportunity where we can see technology mm-hmm. is a way that we distract ourselves from bad feelings or feelings of condemnation, but it's mainly an affirmation machine, a way that I can put out into the world some sort of vision of myself, image of myself that can then get some love or some approval.
Likes, at least.
Likes, yeah. at least. Everything's
and,
likes.
And, you know, that's the thing. Again, what you're talking about makes so much sense when we're actually using terms today like, how many likes did you get? I mean, you're not making this up. People are looking for justification. Anybody who says that the doctrine of justification, God's declaration that we are righteous because of Jesus Christ, anybody who says that that doctrine is no longer relevant, it's not a doctrine that people, you know, should be interested in our age, obviously have never really thought about the ways in which they are seeking self-justification through social
Instagram.
Approval. Yeah.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, in fact, one of the reasons I wrote the book was that I'd heard from usually people within the church who would say, you know, justification, that's antiquated. That's a 16th century question, or that was important then, but now we need to talk about X, Y, or Z. And
how to be affirmed.
How to be affirmed. You want to say, well, listen, have you used a phone ever? Like, have you been on Facebook or have Instagram? Or because if anything, maybe there was a time when people were less interested in this. I don't know of it. But right now, I feel like for folks who believe that this is the central thrust, God's declaration, his gift of righteousness to the sinner, that simply could not be more trenchant in a world that is basically drunk on its self-justification. Hmm. And it's not a young person's problem. Hmm. It's not a rich person's problem. It's everywhere.
Yeah. You say that work may be our single most enthralling replacement religion. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that in America, at least, which is my context, it might not be everyone who's listening to this context, but the American dream is that when people ask you sort of what you do, they just assume, or if you say, have you led a successful life, you assume that you're talking about your career mm-hmm. and not, oh, well, I've spent time with the people I've loved and maybe you'll get there. But I think from the very beginning, there's this idea that we can bootstrap our way to heaven. And so it's very much affirmed. I point out in the book that America leads the world, the developed world, in sort of the least amount of required vacation days. Mm-hmm. But we also lead the world in the most untaken vacation days. So that is meaning we don't have many vacation days to begin with, and we're not even taking those. That, to me, betrays an element of pathology around our relationship with work, that work is somehow a respite from other less manageable realities in life, or it is a place, let me just put it this way, we are looking to work for purpose, for meaning, not just for compensation, but for purpose, for meaning, for community. And oftentimes for identity, you know, we're looking to work for our career to a lot of the things we once looked to God for. Mm-hmm. And this, again, is not a way to say that work or career is bad or in fact, even enjoying what you do. But it is not the sole indicator of your value.
On the flip side, David, how do we turn even leisure and rest into a replacement? I mean, it seems like we either one or the other, you know, we're either turning leisure and rest into religion or it's our work.
Well, you know, I read an article last year, I think, saying that people don't have hobbies anymore. That their hobby stores are going out of business. Hobby stores is usually a euphemism for like basically model train shops. But the idea is that what I do in my free time is, well, I'm running, and I'm not just running, I'm training for a marathon. Or I'd like to do woodworking in my shed, but what I'm really, AKA now, and I've decided I'm going to remodel our house. And so we've turned all of our leisure pursuits into
more work,
and they become a more measurement. And, you know, I got a part of a biking club because we're training for a triathlon instead of just, I like to go biking. So leisure to me is kind of whatever you do for its own sake, just for the enjoyment of it. But in an atmosphere of seculosity, it becomes only important to the extent that it improves your overall score in life. And so instead of making a contribution at the office, you're making a contribution, you know, on the rowing machine or whatever it is. So the other thing is, this is very telling that the they'd have figured out the only way to sell Americans on sleep technology, because right now sleep technology is huge. Sleep hacking. It's called these incredible mattresses. There's been an explosion of mattress companies. The reason this happens is because they finally figured out how to sell Americans on sleep. It's not to tell them it will help them rest if you have a better pillow. It's to tell them that they will be more efficient at work. And so sleep, which is the exact opposite of work, has become completely indentured to achieving more.
Wow.
And that's a very strange situation. And so now you have something called orthosomnia, where people stay up all night worrying about if they're not sleeping well enough. I mean, that's a...
Wow.
That's a... You get orthorexia, too, with food, but it's a strange situation in which there's rest is not valuable in and of itself. It's only constitutive of work.
Wow. What would you say to somebody listening right now who's saying, I get what you're saying, and it's interesting theory, but... I don't see the point. You have to work to make a living. You have to have a family, even if it's, you know, not a wife and kids. You have friends. You have a neighborhood that you look out for. We have technology. This is the world we live in, David. Are you trying to make us feel guilty now for the fact that we work so hard and we have technology and we have responsibilities to our families and so forth?
Well, I want to say that I am the chief of sinners here. I'm a workaholic, and I have a terrible relationship with my phone. So I have no leg to stand on as a person you should put faith in. Let me say that very clearly. I would say, though, that what drives me to church and what drives me, let me put that differently, what drives me to God and to the cross is basically the failure of all of those projects to justify me and to, or at least to save me. And there's plenty of room at the foot of the cross, my friends. This is not another thing for you to feel guilty about. You already feel guilty. That's what the book is trying to say. It's where do we go with that guilt? Do we double down on our careers? Or do we say, and I get there are so many economic realities that are tough. I was just hearing about the housing market in Southern California, and just, I get it. I just don't think that's all that's going on. I think there's also a sense in which we are looking to these things for what only God can provide.
You mentioned a word, orthorexia, and that's actually a word that I had just recently learned. I was preaching through the book of Hebrews and thinking about that text where it's talking about food loss and whatnot, and how in the ancient church you had these problems with right eating. Well, we got the same problem today. I was just reading an article from Vice News not too long ago. One nutritional therapist said, I've absolutely seen a rise in orthorexic patients as a nutrition therapist. It's almost rising exponentially. Now I get a new client every week with orthorexic symptoms. It's a serious problem. There's nothing wrong with eating local or being vegetarian or vegan, she says. I think a lot of those diets are inherently valuable. The problem is that we have moralized eating. Weight, food, and exercise. Food has become presented more and more as the answer. It's a problem today, isn't it?
Oh my gosh.
Moralized food. Wow.
Moralized food. And to, to go hungry because you're so worried about eating the right thing and not eating the wrong thing. It used to be that you knew someone if you knew the stuff, their favorite foods and what they liked to eat. And now today, it's you know someone if you know what they can't eat.
Interesting.
Right? A lot of this health stuff, people will come back at you and say, well, you know, do you not believe in the science? It's like, no, the science is true. But there's when we moralize food to the extent that we do, any kind of eating becomes a drama of guilt and indulgence or self-deprivation and self-righteousness in a way that I think takes the joy out of what is, at least to me, one of the great joys of life.
Yeah. This is who I am. This is where I get my identity. You attack the way I eat and what I believe about food, and I'm going to get upset because I've invested so much in this as a source of my affirmation.
I was just reading an article the other day on the news. A vegan called the police after friends tricked her into eating meat.
No.
Because, I mean, you know, it sort of makes sense in our context, but that's where we are, you know. It's
If you want to go on a deep dive on the internet that's fun, you can look up sort of the vegan video YouTube battles where people are, there's a righteousness around the exact right way to be a vegan that's, it's you know, again, I have respect for friends that eat this way, and but it's
they're not finding their righteousness in it.
No, when food is seen as the path to salvation, not only for the self but for the world, it's a brew that just produces an enormous amount of self-righteousness, and in fact, you know, resentment.
You point out that our national conversation about food is soaked in religious language. You cannot talk about something like fasting without invoking some notion of righteousness. You were just, when we were having lunch earlier, you just held up a can, one of the cans sitting there on the table.
At the bottom of a LaCroix can, and everyone drinks a lot of this stuff these days, it says 0 calories, 0 sweeteners, 0, I think, additives or something like that.
Sodium.
0 sodium equals innocent.
Exclamation point.
Exclamation point. And innocent. I mean, there's a difference between healthy, unhealthy, and guilty, innocent. So you're getting sort of absolution in a can. And I didn't even see, you know, I have married to someone who drinks a lot of that stuff, and I hadn't even noticed it. But that's what they're selling you. They're selling you righteousness.
Give us some more examples.
Well, if you think about it, fasting today, what do we call it? Cleansing. And cleansing is, what are you doing? You're cleaning out your inside. You're purifying your system. That language of purity, people get very worried about the sort of purity culture as it relates to sex in the church. But no one seems to be that worried about the purity culture as it relates to food, which is creating a lot of real, I think, anguish in folks. Think about it. The last time you used the word cheat, were you referring to a broken vow or a diet? People say, oh, I was good, I had a salad, or I'm being bad, I'm going to eat this brownie. So good and bad, this is moral language, and
there, the law.
There is the law, and it's always been linked to food in some, if you read the New Testament, if you read the Torah. I refer to St. Paul in Corinthians, who tells those who are really worried about eating the wrong kind of meat, the meat that had been sacrificed to pagan gods. They were worried that they would be somehow spiritually compromised or less faithful if they ate it. And he says point blank, food will not bring us closer to God. You are no worse off if you eat it and no better if you do. It's a radical rebuke to those of us who would try to find our righteousness or our purity in the kind of food we eat. Again, it's not an invitation to hit the buffet at the Golden Corral or something. Although there's nothing that might, maybe it is, I don't know. I would say, though, that I would not get into the business of litigating people's dietary habits, just full bore.
That's missing the point there of the Apostle Paul, right? What about politics? It doesn't come as a surprise that many people have made a religion out of their politics. But what's striking to me today is how many evangelicals, how many people who describe themselves as evangelicals have turned their politics into a religion. I'm not saying they've taken their politics seriously, and I'm not saying anything about the particular policies, but it was always the liberals who exchanged Christian truth for a progressive social and political agenda. Now you hear fundamentalists doing exactly the same thing and basically identifying the substance of what they believe, the things that are most important to them as evangelicals, being essentially political rather than doctrinal claims.
I think that's unavoidably true. and on all sides of the equation still. Again, when we talk about it being religious, it means we're looking to our political convictions to be our righteousness. I never used to get the question, what are your politics? Or where do you fall politically? Or what are your political convictions? It's now, what are your politics? It's almost like what people say when they tell me about your theology.
Huh.
You know, yeah. So I can sort of put you in a box and figure it out. I think there's a totalizing aspect to politics that sort of it seeks to explain everything. And in a way that, you know, this is why people don't talk about it at cocktail parties, that and religion. So there's something, again, where there's a control factor here that if I can just get the right person into office, then we can usher in basically salvation. And we're sort of looking at the perfectibility of the world. And that used to be a very leftist idea. And now the right seem to have it just as much, that we can kind of usher in God's judgment. So,
and the politics that works is fear in that kind of a scenario, right? You should be terrified because if you don't vote for me, if you don't put me in office, then these 100% evil people over here are going to come get you. And the left does that to the right does that to the left. We're divided in this country over politics as religion.
Mm-hmm. I think it used to be that in generally people's religious beliefs would lead their politics. And that more and more research comes out that the opposite's now true. It hasn't always been true, but you look for a church based on your political beliefs rather than you look for a political party based on your religious beliefs. Mm. And that's a major shift. And, you know, it feels good, I think, to have someone to absorb all the negativity in the world. That's what we call a scapegoat. We're looking for someone, a sacrifice to be made and someone to blame rather than look at oneself. And again, none of this is to say that political questions aren't incredibly important and there aren't lives at stake in a lot of this stuff.
And that there aren't political solutions to some things. But there is no political solution to salvation.
No. That's where we get into trouble. And, you know, you just see it how one candidate is painted as a messiah and the other one is the devil incarnate. And whoever you fill in the blank when you say that, you'd be surprised. It's not just on one side. So, yeah, I think it's a major form of justification now that really brooks no middle ground.
And you kind of fight fire with fire, right? Like if politics has become religion, then it's really going to be the doctrines, the truths of the Christian faith that will fight this off. Like, for instance, original sin. You can't possibly be an Orthodox Christian, little o Orthodox Christian, embracing a profoundly sober, realistic view of human nature after the fall. Sinful condition. You can't possibly believe that. And at the same time think that the solutions to penultimate problems, any more than ultimate problems, are simplistic, that they're not complex, that we're always right about it. Should we be a little more suspicious of ourselves?
Yes, that's what I think. The hermeneutic of suspicion, I'm not necessarily in favor of it when it applies to the scriptures, but that's what repels me about the seculosity of politics is the unassailable certitude about things that are so obviously complicated and multivalent. So it's not that there aren't some certainties in life, but they're less than we think. And right now we're in a situation where it's dueling certainties. And that just becomes a righteousness run amok where the real solution to the world is to get those people out of the way. And we know how it's worked out in wars of religion.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, religious communities might have something to say, might have a positive contribution to make and say, hey, hold on. Once you become the arbiter of all that is good and true and holy, you can justify some pretty awful things.
Yeah. The problem is when the religious community itself trades religion for politics.
Oh, I don't know what you're talking about.
You write, the roots of political division tap into a wellspring as universal as it is subterranean. We are all actively identified with moral narratives that we have largely taken to be true. They are never just stories. They are justifying stories. Otherwise, we wouldn't get so upset when those stories are threatened. Wow, that is so profound and so accurate. Again, if it's an issue where I am using this to justify myself, I'm really going to defend it with might and main. I may not have arguments, but you're going to really, really tick me off if you're going to come at me at the level of what I use to justify myself.
Yes, you can know that someone is, you know, sometimes we get in discussions with people and the reaction that they have is so outsized, according at least from where we're sitting next to what we've said, that you wonder, why is this person so upset? And it's because invariably you've touched on their justifying story. And that's how I actually define religion in the book, the justifying story of your life, not just the controlling story of your life. Mm. It's whatever you're leaning on to tell you that you are
okay.
Okay. T.S. Eliot, again, says that, you know, that so much of the harm that is done in the world is due to people who need to think well of themselves. And you can also see this as the case when internally in political parties, there's a purity battle for who believes something the most and who's the most hardcore. And then you see that in Westboro Baptist Church. You see that in really fundamentalist circles.
But now you see it on the left as well.
Now you see it on the left as well. And sometimes it's a little refreshing, I guess, to remember that this is a universal thing.
Right.
It's not the fault of religion. It's the sin in us. This is why people get so upset when you threaten their justification, or at least their rationalization, or their because our justification, because we know ourselves and we know that we're more compromised than we ever let on, when someone threatens it, they're confirming some inner voice that we already have, and so therefore we're going to blow up.
Folks, right now at our website, we're making an article by David Zoll available free of charge titled Replacement Religion and the Seculosity of Busyness. Just look for it on the front page of our website, whitehorseinn.org. And please remember that the White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast and that we need your help to continue our work. All of our partners get longer editions of our programs without ads, as well as access to our 30-year archive. For more information about joining our partnership program, simply click on the Donate tab at whitehorseinn.org. That's whitehorseinn.org.